This season, we'll be further exploring each topic, hanging out with experts and enthusiasts of all kinds for more strange stories, social commentary, and the myths that make America tick. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith.
For most of my post-adolescent life, I've periodically sunk into what I've come to think of as a crime funk. I was the kind of gloomy child who filched her mother's People magazines to read not about the celebrities, but about the killers and kidnappers and suspicious overdoses. As I got older, my appetite for murder stories seemed to depend on how much turbulence was in my own life. The more sad or lost or angry I felt, the more I craved crime. I was a teenager storming with hormones when I pulled Helter Skelter off my parents' shelf and gave myself Manson family nightmares, and a little older and a lot more depressed when I set out to read every single Manson girl memoir. When I learned that the Columbine killer's journals were online, I read those too.
Today, we're talking about true crime with Rachel Monroe, author of the book Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. This book was so influential for this episode. It was just such an enjoyable and fascinating and just so entertaining at the same time. And so we wanted to have Rachel on to kind of complement some of the things we've been talking about. So thanks so much, Rachel, for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I think that we're definitely cut from the same cloth, and I think you're probably cut from the same cloth as most of our listeners as well. So now we're going to get to know Rachel a little bit. So could you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your work and also kind of your journey into true crime, the fascination with it and kind of the analysis of it or anything related to that that you want to share?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a journalist. I live in rural Texas. And pretty early on in my career, I did start to write a number of crime features. I wrote about a girl in who was kidnapped off the Navajo Nation and went missing there. I wrote about a number of murders out here in rural Texas, and found that really fascinating and also troubling work to do. And I loved writing those pieces, but there was always something that I felt like I couldn't quite say, or there's always more that I wasn't quite able to say, which was sort of had like a meta dimension, like why were these stories so fascinating to me, these stories about other people's tragedies, basically? And why were they so fascinating to other people? Like what was it about these stories that was so compelling when they were so dark? And I don't tend to think of myself as, I don't know. I think if you met me, you'd be like, oh, that's a nice, friendly lady. You wouldn't necessarily like realize how much murder was going on in my brain. I mean, not planning murders, but just like thinking about that's like how much murder content I consumed, particularly the way that I consumed murder content to like relax. That seemed really odd, and something incongruous that I couldn't quite explain. And so that was sort of the genesis of the book, was my interest in confusion about my own preoccupation with these true crime stories, and not just my own. You know, I wrote this kind of at the beginning of this, what people call this recent true crime boom, I guess I would say, and just starting to see out there how much true crime was becoming this collective enterprise, and also how it was like the gender inflection of it was so fascinating, how people equated a true crime fandom with a kind of sisterhood, like girlfriends bonding. So it seemed to me like there were a lot of political, social, cultural, gender dynamics going on there that I wanted to think about, like how this genre functions for people. And true crime, I don't know, maybe because it is a genre that's associated with women, often gets kind of short shrift. It gets treated like trash or, you know, empty calories, basically. And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, you know, these stories are really shaping our cultural and social and political psyches. And they're actually having a really big impact on like actual public policy. They deserve to be taken a little bit more seriously. And this true crime fandom or just interest or fascination that's out there, like that's a potent force in the world. And so I wrote Savage Appetites to sort of give myself the excuse of spending a few years trying to figure out exactly what was going on there.
Totally. We didn't really talk about sort of the implications of true crime being, generally speaking, a women's genre. And so I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts about that phenomenon and also how it, what it has to do with sort of women's liberation and women's feelings and all those really cool things that you talked about in your book.
Yeah, I mean, I think true crime is such a fascinating genre because it weaves together these things that are in some ways like really progressive and also these like really retrograde aspects at the same time. And I think most true crime is neither one nor the other. They fit together in a super complex way. And so I like to try to tease them out. I mean, if you think about somebody like Anne Rule, who was wrote those enormous paperback, like true crime paperbacks in the 80s and 90s mostly. It seems to me like one of the reasons she got so popular is because she was writing about these issues that didn't really, that really impacted women and that didn't have a ton of room to be discussed in more traditional media. Like she wrote a lot about abuse that happened within families, you know, the perfect husband who actually turns out to be, to murder his wife, the family man who's out like secretly murdering sex workers at night. I think we forget how, taboo stories of like particularly, domestic violence, intimate partner violence and child abuse, physical, sexual abuse. Those stories were really considered so taboo for so long, because talking about them disturbed the sanctity, you know, of the nuclear family. You don't want to like trouble that. That's the building block of our society. And once you start talking about what really goes on in there, you know, maybe it's all going to fall down. And so she exploded that in some ways. And I think that's why those books are so enormously popular in a way, like people saw reflections of their own relationships being talked about in a way that there weren't other outlets for them. And just, you know, I talk in the book a lot about the victims' rights movement, which itself came out of it had these radical roots in it, and what it turned into is something very different from that. But I think we have to, before we sort of criticize the carceral feminism that arose out of it, we also have to acknowledge that it was addressing a real need. I mean, we think about things like victim impact statements that are such a key part of when we think of trials, that seems like so baked in there, like such a important and foundational part of the justice system. But I mean, that's like so recent, you know, that there until the victims' rights movement started pushing for a role for victims, there was often, unless you were sort of testifying as a witness, if you were the victim of a crime, you kind of didn't really have a role in the court proceedings at all. The crime was like a crime against the state, right? It wasn't against you, even though like you were the person who was maybe physically harmed. And so creating a role for victims, for them to be able to talk about things, that like early victims' rights movement was all about training police officers to like understand how trauma responses. I mean, all these things that they still definitely like need to happen, but those were all identifying gaps in the justice system, like where the justice system was failing victims. And so that's all the like really exciting progressive stuff that came out of it. And then at the same time, I think you have true crime, the worst aspects of it, it's like, to me, is when these are stories that sort of teach us to only look at one kind of pain, if that makes sense. Particularly pain that like resembles most true crime audience, you know, right, being like middle-class white women. And so if those are the only people we can conceive of as victims, or the only people who like fit, when we hear the word victim, the only image that like pops up in our mind, then we risk doing more harm than good, right? Because we're enacting policies that only benefit like a very small slice of the population that doesn't actually reflect like the real victims of crime in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think that was just I just had never thought of true crime in that way. And so I really appreciated that. And I think Another part of true crime that we didn't really get into, but is totally relevant to what you're just talking about, is the idea of the perfect victim. And as is obvious from true crime, that's usually white women and children who are less likely to be victims of violent crime. And I think something that was really interesting for me to learn about while making this episode was the fact that serial killer demographics are also not reflected well in terms of serial killers who are not white men or women, or most often white men, and sort of the root of that being that we're not interested in victims of color, given that most violence is interracial. And I just thought that was just a really profound way, as obvious as it is, for me to learn about it, being that like we are only interested in the killers of those who represent kind of the status quo, white women and children.
Totally. I mean, it's like how much content can be like milked out of Ted Bundy at this point, you know, like it's so, but it's because he was in some ways, like if you were a Hollywood director and you like wanted to tell a story and you wanted it to be like involved, like a young man and like a young theoretically attractive man and a bunch of like college girls, then like that's who you want to cast, right? But that's like in no way reflects reality, and people will say like, oh well, why does it matter? But if this is, I mean, that's true crime exists at this super interesting and I think troubling intersection of entertainment and news, right? And so if people are consuming all this true crime content, that gives us in large part our understanding of what risk and vulnerability and danger look like. And if we're getting like a super distorted picture of who is at risk and who is creating that risk, then I think it's not that far of a step to like these really messed up policies that have led to mass incarceration.
So just to pivot a little bit, but I feel like we're kind of in the same vein here still, is in your book, you also talk about sort of the fandom aspect of true crime, which we also didn't really get into. But we have, you know, this example that you give that's so fascinating about these people that you refer to, and I think they're referred to in general as Columbiners, and especially as serial killers have phased out a little bit more with DNA evidence, we're sort of seeing these spree shooters in schools and in, you know, other public places. And so I'm interested if you could talk a little bit about kind of the Columbiners, the serial killer fandom, and maybe what kind of like psychological mechanisms you think are at play there, or anything related to that that you want to share.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I find the Columbiners so fascinating. I started writing about them like, I think it was like 8 years ago now. I found this subculture then on Tumblr, still largely on Tumblr, of teenage girls. At the time, it was mostly teenage girls using the kind of Tumblr language of like crush fandom, but the object of their affection was the Columbine shooters. And there was this very fascinating and like super dark way that they would mix this like girly kind of squeeing with like crime scene photos and stuff like that. And I guess there was a part of me that wanted to defend them, I guess, at first, because I mean, maybe it's my contrarianness. Maybe it was also the part of me that could imagine like if I was 13, like thank God there was no Tumblr when I was 13. Like God only knows how I would have, you know, express myself online. But it seems to me like these girls, it wasn't simple what they were saying. And what I saw a lot of them saying through this fandom, although on its surface, it was like really shocking and repellent. What they were using it to talk about their own depression, their own rage, their own experience of being bullied, of being outcasts. I think this is often something that we see like teenage girls do with their crushes, right? It's like a way of externalizing something that you can't quite own about yourself. And so you project it onto somebody else and you say like, oh, I love him. And that's really just a part of yourself that you can't own up to. So you're like displacing. And so what did it mean then to like have all these girls in some way identifying with these sort of like famously violent, troubled boys. And I think, you know, too often when we find something like shocking or offensive, the response is to sort of like shut it down, right? Say like, oh, that's bad. And maybe it's an invitation to look closer. And that was definitely my immediate reaction at first. And then I just kept following this subculture over the years, kind of checking back in. And in my book, I end up writing about a girl who was a member of the subculture who ended up planning a mass shooting of her own. And when I was checking in with it sort of after the 2016 election, I couldn't tell if like the vibe was different or if I was just seeing it with different eyes. There was like a lot of, I just became a lot more aware of like the troubling aspects of it, the kind of ironic racism that we were seeing a lot of in 2016 and around then, where you're like, is ironic racism, isn't it actually just racism, you know, like with a weird internet spin on it, and the fetishization of violence. All of that was like all mixed in there together. So I ended up sort of feeling a lot more complicated about it, particularly, you know, when there was this like planned shooting that came out of this community. But I mean, there's still a part of me that thinks like, that it's easy in some ways to blame and shame these teenage girls for this fandom, which, you know, is obviously troubling. But if we think about our culture as a whole, like there's just so much focus on serial killers. I mean, I think we're doing a little bit better. We're like, maybe as a culture, we're like slightly more aware of this. We try to like fetishize them less, but there's just so many books and podcasts and TV shows that are just like zoom in on like what was he wearing, what did his manifesto say, what was he thinking, what was his childhood like, and like we've made them into celebrities essentially, and celebrities acquire groupies. Like that is just something that happens with celebrity, and so it's easy, I think, to like point a finger at a 13-year-old, you know, with a drawing hearts on Ted Bundy on her Tumblr and say it's her. But like, no, I think it's all of us, right? Like all of us who are sort of contributing to this serial killer celebrity culture. Maybe we all need to like look at ourselves instead of.
Yeah.
Blaming.
I think that's the general vibe of our show. So I think I definitely would have had a similar experience of just like, how can we not do sort of the victim criminal dichotomy, you know, the good, bad, like, because I think a lot of teens too are being transgressive. That's something that we run into again and again. I think of like Satanism from the 1980s and 90s, you know, all these little towns panicking because teenagers are running around drawing, you know, satanic symbols on concrete somewhere out there, you know? And so it's like, how much of it is kind of transgression, rebellion? Do you have any insight in that? Because I think I think the idea of teenage transgression can explain a lot more than we think.
Totally. And it's like so terrible to be a teenager, you know? Like what an incredibly dark time of life, you know? How can you not be totally like miserable and angry and frustrated and alienated? And I think, you know, the question is like, how do we like create space for kids to express that and like deal with it without allowing them to have access to like firearms, right? Just in case, you know, things like spill over a little too far. But yeah, I think, I mean, there's just so much panic also. I mean, after Columbine, I write about this a bit in the book, there was so much panic about like teenagers having a life on the internet that was not sort of visible or accessible to their parents. I think that was another reason that story was like so struck fear into the hearts of people, because it did intersect with like early youth internet culture. You know, these guys are playing these violent video games, they have these secret blogs where they're issuing death threats, you know, what are your kids doing online? And I think the panic over Columbiners is like similar. It's like, oh, these girls are expressing themselves online, but we don't like what we see, you know, when they feel like they have some sort of like anonymous free reign to do so.
Totally. I think it's part of being a teenager, testing those boundaries, testing kind of like cultural norms and what can you not do? What can you get away with? And I think in a way it's not dissimilar to the boom in true crime right now and sort of the shame that we put onto women or the scrutiny of like, what is it that women are getting from this? And I think one of the ways you explore that in such an interesting complicated way is your time at CrimeCon. And CrimeCon, if you want to explain what that is and kind of talk about what that's like and your experience being there.
Yeah, CrimeCon is so fascinating. It's a fan convention, essentially, for true crime put on by Oxygen, the cable channel that pivoted to being all crime all the time a number of years ago. And so it's, in some ways, it's like the perfect place to go and write about like where true crime is today, because you have at once these very serious panels about wrongful convictions, talking about like investigating cold cases, people like very sort of justice minded. There was a great article in the Washington Post a few years ago about a man whose sister was murdered who would go there to sort of drum up attention for these cold cases. But then at the same time, you have the like totally pretty like tawdry, like the wine and crime happy hour. They have a thing where you can like take a selfie. It's like a mugshot, or you can, they have like a chalk outline of a body on the ground and you like pose in that. So at that point, it's just like clear the total like voyeurism. Obviously like those things wouldn't be fun to do unless you're thinking of crime as something that like happens to, like people somewhere else, like, right. Like people over there, if you thought about like somebody in your own family being arrested or being murdered, like it wouldn't be fun to pose as a mugshot or like in a chalk outline. But if it's just like this entertainment on TV that happens to other people, then it could be like fun reality TV essentially. And so it's being there for me. It was also in this like insane hotel in New Orleans. Oh no, in Nashville when I went there, that I just like didn't leave. It was like this very Las Vegas-y hotel with like a fake sky, you know, with fake stars. And I just like didn't leave this like compound or see the sun for like 4 days, which probably also contributed to my like psychic state. But it's, yeah, it was just this swing back and forth between like all of these different needs, like psychic and emotional and psychological and intellectual needs that that true crime can address. Like some that I feel really good about, some that I feel really gross about, and just having it like concentrated all at once. And you definitely, I mean, there were like definitely lots of like mother and daughter pairs. There were people there on like bachelorette, you know, girls weekend, like let's eat our cupcakes and drink our champagne and like talk about murder. And then, yeah, like I said, like people there kind of trying to drum up justice. And so it was really fascinating. It was also like a very white crowd, very female crowd, very white crowd. And so it was just a lot of like the dynamics that are at play in pop true crime right now were like all out right there.
Writ large. Yeah.
Extremely.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So just to kind of pivot gears, I know that you have also kind of been a travel writer in the past, and you've done some like, I don't know, some traveling that could be considered risky. And I have also done that. I used to hitchhike and travel in my truck and do sort of all these things where pretty frequently someone would say, you're probably going to get murdered. And I wondered if that was like how people saw you sort of as that potential victim, if that's true. And I don't know, just your experiences as a female traveler out in the world where that is so deeply discouraged.
That's so interesting. You know, it's funny, like the most dangerous trip that I've probably ever taken is this reporting trip recently where I went to a TikTok house in LA where it was just like 50 teenagers like hugging me, you know, without a mask. So like, our sense of like what is truly dangerous is maybe distorted. I fortunately tested negative. I was like very, but I was like, wow, this is probably the biggest risk I've ever taken for my job is like these TikTokers, these crazy TikTokers.
That's beautiful.
But yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time in the Middle East and traveled around there is probably like what people would maybe like think of as dangerous. I don't know. I like camp a lot alone in my truck, but I don't even think about that as dangerous anymore. But yeah, I think these stories of these crime stories, you often see like particularly it's like so clear also when you look back at the true crime magazines from like the 40s and 50s and 60s, even like how much they're used to police female behavior. And again, you know, like the idea of the vulnerable white woman, it's being portrayed as a victim. It's like theoretically like a position of privilege, right? We're like honoring you, but it also is a way of like putting people in a box and saying, you know, this is what happens if you like work and like live alone in the city, or this is what happens if you hitchhike, or this is what happened if you like go on dates with the wrong guy or
restricting
something.
Restricting women's movement,
exactly.
Right? Is such a big part of it. Yeah,
exactly. And I don't think it has to come to outright victim blaming, which, you know, we're better at calling that out now, but if we're just sort of inundated over and over again with these stories of like, this is what happens if you're moving freely through the world. I think we can sort of almost like internalize that victim blaming in a way. So I guess in my own life, I do try to resist that. I don't know. I never feel afraid in the woods.
I know.
Is that true?
Either.
Maybe I shouldn't say that. But I don't. That's not what seems scary.
I mean,
to me.
My truth is that I go on hikes alone in the woods listening to true crime podcasts. That's my deepest kind of soul expression, I feel like.
You know, if I never get married, then I've like cut down my risk of being murdered by so much. If you just don't cohabitate with a man, then like
get out of your parents' house.
Exactly.
And don't get married.
Yeah.
Then you're going to be fine.
You know, like you're probably good.
I mean, it's also, I don't know. I've been calling serial killers like adult stranger danger a little bit because it feels the numbers are really similar to sort of the actual number of children taken versus women killed by serial killers versus, of course, more often it being parents, community members, or husbands or boyfriends. So I think that that's very relevant. So the other thing I wanted to ask you was, I know that you spoke to people like Doris Tate and like Damien Echols and, of course, all of the press around Damien and around this really sensational story of the West Memphis Three. We can kind of forget the real person. I would love to hear what it was like to get to know someone who's in such an insane story that has so much lore and misinformation around it, and just getting to know the subject of true crime in the kind of intimate way that you did.
Yeah. And I definitely spent much more time with Lori Davis, his partner, than with Damien himself. But the thing that really struck me about him was how sick he was, frankly, of talking about this case, which, I mean, in his situation, it's interesting, right? Because these murders that happened to him, they had nothing to do with him, right? He was wrongfully convicted for murders.
Well, and maybe we should really quickly say, like, the briefest background to that case.
There, it's like really a horrific crime that has remains unsolved, where 3 8-year-old boys were found killed and apparently mutilated in the woods in West Memphis, Arkansas, and 3 teenage boys who were sort of like the local misfits, you know, like wearing black, listening to Metallica, got essentially railroaded for this crime and were sent to prison for a long time. Or Damien himself was on death row for almost 2 decades before they eventually got out. But yeah, Damien, I mean, and could feel this even a little bit with Doris Tate too, where these crimes that have really shaped and structured their lives in some ways have almost frozen their lives in a way, like at that point of trauma. And I think that's true of trauma in any case, but it's also true of like the, when you live through a very like public crime, I think it's also like the way that other people see you is sort of not allowed to grow beyond that point. So Damien's like really into all this like super esoteric magic philosophy stuff. That's all he wants to talk about. He just wants to like be known as like the magic man. And of course, you know, but the reason people are drawn to him was because of this case that he was at the center of, and not just like having been on death row, you know, an innocent man on death row for so long. And just how so interesting to me how like financially, in order to essentially like have a living, he sort of has to tell this story over and over again and find a way to like, you know, tour the country. And that's how he gets an audience. But also at the same time, like he's so sick of it. He so wants to move beyond it. And I felt that even a little bit with Doris too, like this, there's this trauma, but it's also the only thing that it's also like a weirdly like lucrative trauma. And I think particularly for people, you know, like if you've been in prison for 20 years, it's not like you have this like resume that you can fall back on of, you know, like to earn money on. And so I think that's just such a complicated trap that people who've been at the center or the periphery of a famous crime kind of fall into. And it just seems like a really hard to have to sort of constantly like relive the worst thing that happened to you, because that's the only way that you can, or one of the only ways you can like make any money.
I really like how you put that, how someone's kind of frozen in time. And it's like, I imagine Damien attempting to sort of integrate the self that he wants to be with this person who he sort of needs to be, like you're saying, in order to, I mean, how do you have a life after you've been in prison for that many years and you've missed out on the entire time that you create your underlying career, right? And so it makes sense that people would need to sort of cultivate that while at the same time trying to define themselves differently. It just must be, it's unimaginable. And I hope that we keep that in mind, not to be moralistic about true crime, because that is also not my goal in any way.
Yeah.
So just to kind of wind down, I'd love to just talk about the victims' rights movement again and the sort of tough on crime policies that have unfortunately complemented it. And I wanted to know, like, what is your perspective on how true crime is affecting that right now? Because I think we also have a lot of what you could call good true crime, or true crime that's attempting to sort of almost combat the true crime of the past through exposing injustices and the prison industrial complex and you know, people who've been wrongly accused and things like that. And so I was wondering, where do you see true crime going in terms of the victims' rights movement, tough on crime, and the future of things like mass incarceration?
Yeah. And I mean, I've tried to catch myself, because I often frame things sort of like the way that you just did, sort of like good true crime and bad true crime. But I'm trying to like do less of that, because I do think, and you were kind of alluding to this earlier, there is this sense of there can be like a scolding when people talk about like women's consumption of true crime. And then you see this, the response to that is sometimes people trying to reframe true crime as virtuous. And I don't know, I guess I don't, yeah. And I don't necessarily feel like we need to defend all of the culture that we consume as morally upstanding or making the world a better place. I mean, just like all, you know, all the food that we eat doesn't need to be like a kale salad, you know, like superfood, whatever. It's like, but I do like my true crime with like a little bit more attention to context, I guess. And that's what I feel like is missing. These stories can be so hyper activating of our like emotions, like our mirror neurons, right? Like all of our like empathy juices or whatever. And I think the danger there is that if you're not paying attention to the wider context, there's this tendency, and you hear this a lot, the cheering of like, they got him, you know, like when the, yeah. when the quote unquote mm-hmm. bad guy is apprehended, and some of them are like, do terrible things. When they're caught, we cheer. And if their like sentence is not necessarily like what we thought, then we're like, what's wrong? Like lock them up. And I think, that's very understandable when we're presented with these like very emotional stories. But what's missing there is like a sense of how that cheering on like harsh punishment is usually not like the vast majority of the time, like those policies aren't levied against these rare like violent criminals, but like have these trickle down effects that affect already vulnerable communities. And so just being aware that this kind of like cheering pro punishment attitude, I think we need to have the little voice in our head saying like, okay, but who else is going to be harmed? What are we actually cheering for or advocating for here? Rather than just
like a little bit of like, sorry, like a trickle down Reagan incarceration.
Yeah, exactly. Just sort of like thinking about like, okay, what is really being advocated for here? And is it just to like satisfy me, my need for vengeance, narrative vengeance in this moment? Mm-hmm. But like, what does that actually mean? And yeah. And you know, there's like an interesting turn where I think I've just heard from like a number of the true crime cable stations that are like trying to, there's this desperate scramble now that I think is really interesting where they're trying to find stories of victims, like non-white victims, which is like, oh, like a little too late, guys, but also good, I guess, in a way. But still, I think this idea of framing this story around like the sympathetic or like quote unquote innocent victim, which is sort of like, sometimes feels like the only stories that true crime, pop true crime knows how to tell. That's just such a limiting vocabulary. So even if you have more diversity among the cast, you're still essentially telling the same story. And so I wonder.
You don't have a framework, exactly. A different cultural framework exactly. to put it in.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And to give it its value, right? To tell the story so that it has some sort of demonstrative value of what the culture is like expressing something larger, which I don't think we're going to get on Oxygen all the time. Right.
Exactly. But
maybe.
Yeah. I mean,
No shame.
I think there's like a lot more interest and awareness of things like wrongful convictions. I think that for a long time, those stories, just people didn't understand them or didn't believe that it was possible to have a false confession, or, you know, that right. people trusted so much in forensic science. And I think some of those tropes are really being disrupted in part by true crime, you know? So like true crime yeah. taught us about the legal system. Now it's also teaching us about the holes in the legal system. And that, you know, like law enforcement can't always be believed. Sometimes it's weird. Sometimes they're the murderers, you know? So
yeah.
So I do think the stories are becoming more complicated, and that's good to know.
That's good.
Yeah.
Complicated, I think, is what we need. We need that nuance back, right? The other thing I want to do on these interview episodes is sort of get your perspective on how our topic, which is true crime, relates to the topic we're covering next, which is fake news or conspiracy theories, propaganda, disinformation. So I was interested if you see any connection between true crime and fake news.
Yeah, I mean, I think true crime is such an activating genre. It really stokes your emotions and gives you the sense that you need to sort of have an immediate response. And to me, that really aligns with what we see in that sort of world of propaganda and fake news. I mean, first of all, that it's like that heightened emotionalism is like something that keeps people engaged. And I feel like we're seeing that more and more. This like engagement is the thing that's prioritized above everything else because it's like financially rewarding, right? So you keep people watching whether or not something is true. It just needs to be engaging. So that sort of heightened emotionalism seems to me to be like something that they both play into, and they both demand almost like an immediate reaction. You can't be like, I'd like to like wait and know more. And you have to be like, that's terrible. You know, like we need justice. That leap to immediate reaction and immediate answers is kind of rewarded by like the shape of the content in a way.
And you also have these sensational villains, right?
Exactly.
These like larger than life, whether it's a satanic elite cult or, you know, John Wayne Gacy, a clown child.
And
murderer,
it's so hard,
right?
To like, it's so hard. I mean, I was thinking about this so much when this was like a few years ago now, when do you remember when Trump had a press conference and brought out these enormous photographs of people who had been killed by people in the country illegally. And then he like autographed them for some reason, as if anybody wants like an autographed photo of their dead child. But, you know, and you can sit there, and then they had like the grieving parents there, and you could sit there and sort of quote all the statistics, which, you know, hopefully we all know, which is that like people in the country illegally commit crimes at a much lower rate than, you know, people like you and me, native born citizens. But there's no sort of refuting that like emotionality of the anecdote, right? There's just sort of no way to talk back against it. Otherwise you're like negating, you know, this weeping mother.
Right.
And so I think we see these things like also like politically mobilized in a super savvy and callous way.
Yeah. So I want to end on just this question of, is there anything in your life, any hysteria, moral panic, conspiracy theory, anything like that, that has touched your life? We would love if it were something that you once believed that you found out not to be true. But if it's just something that's touched your life outside in some way, too, we'd love to hear about that.
I don't know if this counts as a conspiracy theory, but I was thinking about this story. Like the most recent story that I wrote was all about stolen valor, which is like people lying about their military history. And I got interested in this because I have to talk about this vaguely, but I have to, like, somebody very close to me is involved with a total liar, bullshit man.
Okay. Con man.
A con man. Yes. And it just like offends me to my very core that this lovely woman is enmeshed with this liar. And I just felt so outraged by it. And then I did what I often do when I like, I'm fascinated by somebody. I'm like, can I turn this into a story and write about it? And then in the course of doing the reporting for it, I came to see, you know, like, oh, actually this is like a much more complicated situation than it's like often portrayed. It's like so easy to just go out there and like, just want like blood, be like, this is just like this person is a liar and all these people are liars and they need to be taken down and publicly shamed. And then, you know, the more you look into it, you're like, oh, there's often like mental health stuff going on. And the rage that I feel is like so easily mobilized by these online mobs. And is it just kind of upholding the reverence that we have for the military? Like, and then so that I just sort of came away having, you know, my rage just got like diffused as I realized this was like not quite as simple a story as I thought that it was at first. But the simple story is so morally satisfying. I miss it.
Isn't it?
I miss it a little
Isn't
bit,
it?
You know, but I guess
yeah,
it's
like the cops, what you gonna do, bad boys.
Exactly.
That's simplicity, that true crime's like final form in a way.
Yeah,
like
completely.
Final form. Oof. Yeah. Well, I would love if you told people where they could read your new piece, Stolen Valor, too.
It's in the New Yorker. It's in the magazine, on the website. I think the title of it is Stolen Valor, but if you just
I think so, because I have a tab open. I'm really looking forward to reading it. And it's perfect because we're talking about some personality hoaxes and other kind of big hoaxes in American history, which feel exactly on par.
Ooh,
with that.
So exciting.
Is there anything that you would like to tell the audience to check out, new work you've been doing, anything like that?
You know, no, like stay tuned for this TikTok story. Don't go to any TikTok houses. Avoid the teenagers. They're not safe.
What is this, a teen COVID party?
I mean, basically.
We've been hearing about.
Basically.
That's a good one. So yeah, make sure you check out Savage Appetites. It's such a good book. And I just am so grateful that you wrote it and grateful for all the work you did and just how in the field you were. And it was just, I can't recommend it enough. So thank you for all your work. And thank you for talking to us today. This has been so great.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for your excellent podcast.
Thanks everyone for listening to our first in this interview series for season 4. Next time on the show, we'll be covering the phenomenon of fake news, a long-awaited topic for American hysteria, and it's coming on, that's right, the night before the election. And that reminds me, if you're listening, please vote, and please do it as soon as you can. If you love American Hysteria, please consider becoming a patron. You'll get extra content each month, including extra episodes, interviews, and videos. Also consider coming and following us on social media and leaving us a review. It really helps the show out. This episode was produced by Miranda Zickler with sound by Clear Camo Studios. Thanks, as always, for listening. And one more time, please vote. Have a great week.